Hello, and welcome to Wilderness Medicine Updates, the podcast for medical providers at the edges. I'm your host, Patrick Fink. Today, we're going to review the evidence around mechanical CPR for ski patrol and mountain rescue use. The ski season is transitioning to spring right now, and it's time for organizations to look forward, plan training and equipment for the next season. Even if you're not in ski patrol, the subject of mechanical CPR and its potential benefits or harms is important for any medical rescuer who interfaces with EMS services or faces the possibility of prolonged transports or extrications in tough environments. Let's start with a case. You're called from your ski resort to respond to a high-altitude backcountry avalanche just outside your boundary, which buried one male skier. The scene is safe when you arrive. He was buried for over an hour, and when the dogs locate him and you dig him out, he's pulseless. But when excavated, he had a large air pocket around his head, and his core temperature shows that he's profoundly hypothermic. You listened to our episode number 4 on the HOPE score, and you know that this pulseless and profoundly hypothermic patient needs both CPR and rewarming. You start your resuscitation on site, but the afternoon is warming rapidly, and the risk of additional avalanches is increasing. You face the prospect of an evacuation on a toboggan or transport in a helicopter from the scene. Patroller Big Muscles suggests that he can do compressions in the toboggan to the LZ or out to the road, no problemo. But you can't help but wonder if this would be effective or even safe. Do you wish you had mechanical CPR available to you now? At Snowbird Ski Resort, we had a debate last year about whether or not to get a mechanical CPR device, like a Lucas or AutoPulse, to aid in our cardiac arrest care. If you're not familiar with these devices, take a look at the video link at the top of the show notes. But in short, they're mechanical devices that can be fixed around a patient's chest that perform the work of doing compressions, freeing rescuers to perform other tasks. There was hesitation about using mechanical CPR, with some opponents citing that these devices are expensive and that there isn't data to demonstrate improved outcomes when they're used in comparison to manual CPR, the old-fashioned way, compressing on the chest. Indeed, there is some evidence of increased complications, like damage to visceral organs, when it's compared to manual CPR. Plus, an experienced patroller can do CPR in a moving toboggan, right? Not really. We'll get to the question of CPR in a toboggan momentarily, but first I want to talk about why you would want to move an arrest patient at a ski resort. There's a great paper in Resuscitation 2017 by Viglino et al. That looked at survival of cardiac arrest patients on ski slopes in the Northern Alps over a 10-year period. They identified 136 on-slope arrest events and found that, compared to cardiac arrest more broadly, patients who had an arrest on the hill were younger, more often had an initial shockable rhythm, more often had bystander CPR, and had a much shorter time to defibrillation. As you might expect, because of that, 30-day survival was much higher at 21% compared to 5.9%, even when they accounted for other variables that could affect survival. The takeaway from this study is that cardiac arrests on the ski hill are more likely to result in saves, are more likely to respond to basic life support level interventions, and for that reason, it makes good sense to prioritize high-quality CPR as much as possible. In most cases, this is going to mean that the patroller team should do their BLS or ACLS resuscitation on site, and should only transport the patient if they get a return of spontaneous circulation, because that strategy prioritizes the high-quality CPR and defibrillation that gets good results, and it doesn't interrupt them with moving the patient. So why would you move the patient? A few reasons come to mind, and some are better than others. First, it's possible that the patient could be somewhere that quality CPR is either not feasible or safe, like in our case. In the setting of a recent avalanche, warming snow conditions increase site avalanche hazard. Or perhaps the patient collapsed on a slope of firm snow with slope angle that doesn't permit working there on a firm flat surface. Second, a patient could be profoundly hypothermic, as after a prolonged avalanche burial. And in this setting, it may be necessary to perform compressions until they can be rewarmed in hospital, in which case it'll be necessary to transport that patient with compressions ongoing. Third, In a case where it's unclear whether collapse was due to trauma or cardiac arrest, say if a patient seems to faint, lose postural tone, or fall while skiing and then strikes a fixed object, posing the question of whether they had a cardiac arrest and then had trauma or whether trauma caused their cardiac arrest, it might make sense to transport that patient to the base or clinic where advanced traumatic arrest care can be provided if it can't be delivered to them on the hill. I'm talking about interventions like venting the chest or performing pericardiocentesis. Finally, it may be beneficial for ski resort operations to continue a resuscitation until the patient is off the hill and in a controlled environment before terminating a resuscitation. This is because, in the U.S. at least, the unattended death of a cardiac arrest patient becomes a crime scene of sorts until the scene can be released by the medical examiner. So transporting the patient off the hill in cases of futile resuscitation can prevent disruption of resort operations. This obviously should only be done if there's no further benefit to resuscitating the patient, so we're not interrupting useful interventions. So if you have to move a patient with ongoing CPR, a toboggan is likely how that's going to happen at a ski resort. Possibly a helicopter. You can just do CPR in a toboggan, right? The fact that CPR can be done in a toboggan does not mean that it should, or that it is of any quality. I'm also skeptical of the use of mechanical CPR in controlled environments with lots of manpower, like in my emergency department. But I think that these concerns are limited to urban and in-hospital environments where there's a lot more resources and the setting is much more controlled. There's a trial called the LINC trial that's the most commonly cited paper to show no improvement in 4-hour survival when using mechanical CPR. This was a randomized clinical trial performed in an urban setting. And the most pertinent takeaway for me from this study is that survival in both groups was actually the same, about 23%, with mechanical CPR compared to manual. So depending on how you want to bend those results, you can also point out that mechanical CPR wasn't inferior in quality to manual CPR. The Wilderness Medicine Society guidelines on the care of avalanche victims gives a strong recommendation based on some low-quality evidence that mechanical CPR can be used in the case of avalanche victims, recognizing that there is evidence that CPR quality is low under, quote, difficult transport conditions, even when performed by professional rescuers. I think that the evidence here is actually stronger than they suggest. Let's dive into the data on mechanical CPR in challenging situations. Mechanical CPR has been shown to be likely superior in helicopter rescue, a scenario that is likely similar to a toboggan in terms of physical hurdles to high performance, like lack of space in a moving environment or altitude. A simulated mannequin study by Putzer et al. In the American Journal of Emergency Medicine in 2013 showed that CPR quality and hands-off time was lower when using a Lucas in a helicopter. And they didn't even fly the helicopter in this study, which would probably strengthen the findings in favor of Lucas. Notably, the time to first defibrillation was longer in the Lucas group by about 20 seconds, and whether that's clinically meaningful is not known. Additionally, there are multiple studies showing that manual CPR quality declines quickly at altitude, which makes sense because doing good CPR is hard and physically taxing. Wang et al. Published a study entitled "The Physiological Effects and Quality of Chest Compressions During CPR at Sea Level and High Altitude," published in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine in 2014. The title tells you what they were after. It compared CPR quality at sea level versus 3,100 meters, call that 9,500 feet, 10,000 feet, using unacclimatized rescuers, and they found a significant decrease of CPR quality after just 30 seconds of compressions at altitude compared to 120 seconds at sea level. It's worth noting that that decrease in CPR quality after just 30 seconds means that even a fresh rescuer can't make it through a 2-minute round of compressions with that degraded quality. Okay, maybe using unacclimatized rescuers was unfair. Let's look at another mannequin study by Egger et al. In the Scandinavian Journal of Trauma and Emergency Medicine, entitled "Influence of Physical Strain at High Altitude on the Quality of Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation." They subjected 20 experienced mountaineers of the Austrian Mountain Rescue Service to performing CPR first at 2,250 meters, and then after a rapid 1,200-meter ascent to another session at 3,545. They randomized, so half started at the higher altitude and then went down to the lower altitude to account for potential fatigue between these situations. They measured the fraction of compressions that reached the target depth to determine high-quality CPR at both altitudes. Target compression depth fraction decreased by 55% in the altitude group, and they also showed a lower duration of the release phase of CPR, which suggests that compression quality dropped as rescuers became fatigued, and they more or less leaned on the chest and didn't compress as deeply. This study didn't show any differences in hands-off time or compression rates. The conclusion of this second paper, as written by the authors, is most apt. It says, physical strain during a realistic alpine rescue mission scenario at high altitude led to a significant reduction in quality of resuscitation. Resuscitation guidelines developed at sea level are not directly applicable in the mountain terrain. I think that these three studies make this point pretty well. Confined spaces, high altitudes, these are not the same as spacious ambulances at sea level or controlled emergency departments. Another thought that came up when we were talking about deploying Lucas was the idea that intermittent CPR is an acceptable alternative when transportation is difficult. Intermittent CPR is on-again, off-again CPR, and it's a strategy that's been case-reported in people who are severely hypothermic and need prolonged extrications. It's supported by the Wilderness Medicine Society guideline on management of severe hypothermia, but it's appropriate only for very cold patients for whom there is no alternative. I don't think anyone could reasonably assert that intermittent CPR is adequate in a normothermic patient, as there's ample available evidence on the need for high-quality, uninterrupted CPR as the primary intervention in cardiac arrest. So do you think you can do quality CPR in a moving toboggan? A sensible person, knowing what we've already discussed, would probably think not, but there are some holdouts in the world of ski patrol who make it a badge of pride to think that they could do a good job. Indeed, Cascade, the toboggan company, makes a model called the Trauma One. It's designed to allow two rescuers to, quote, safely perform CPR using fold-down seats and waist harnesses in a moving toboggan. There's a great video from Alyeska Ski Resort of their proposed method of performing high-performance CPR in a moving toboggan. Link below in the show notes. The long and the short of this technique is that they have a rescuer performing compressions and perform periodic stops during transport to change compressors. They don't perform any kind of ventilations during transport. While this looks like a high-performing crew who've trained well on the technique, if you watch, it's really easy to imagine using the Lucas here, which would spare multiple stops along the route of transport, as well as the risk of the rescuer who's performing CPR in the moving toboggan. So maybe a high-performing crew can supplant a Lucas device. Maybe the resort can be spared the cost of training. Has anyone ever studied CPR in a toboggan? Well, I was teamed up with University of Utah resident Dr. Jared Patel and planning to answer this question when we learned that we'd been beaten to the punch. Dr. Scott Rupp and Ryan Overberger presented a study of CPR in toboggans to the Wilderness Medicine Society a few years ago that was completed at Big Boulder Ski Area in Pennsylvania, and they currently have a preprint manuscript under review. To emphasize, this is not yet peer-reviewed data, and I share here only what was presented at the conference. They did 8 runs down a test slope using a mannequin and compared manual to Lucas CPR, measuring compression fraction and high-quality CPR fraction, which is measured by a Zoll monitor algorithm. They found that mechanical CPR compression fraction wasn't statistically different from manual, with a compression fraction of around 91% in both groups. But the high-quality CPR fraction was much higher, 58% in the Lucas group versus 25% in the manual group. This certainly reinforces the idea that the quality of manual CPR in a toboggan is quite low, and while Lucas doesn't make it perfect, it definitely improves compression quality. This certainly reinforces the idea that manual CPR quality in a toboggan is quite low, and while Lucas doesn't make it perfect, it definitely improves compression quality. And this is at a low-elevation ski resort where rescuer fatigue is less pronounced, and we'd expect it to only get worse at higher altitudes because of the studies that we've discussed. So with all these studies in mind, I think that having a Lucas or similar mechanical device available is likely to improve the outcomes of on-hill arrests in select cases, and will certainly ensure that we deliver the best CPR possible when transporting these patients to the base of the mountain, to a landing zone, etc. These benefits are likely to be greater in patrols with lower manpower, at higher altitudes, or in any case where a patient needs to be moved with ongoing CPR. There, the benefit is clear. If a patrol isn't able to afford a Lucas or implement the needed training, it makes a lot of sense to stop the practice of transporting patients with ongoing CPR and focus on high-quality pit crew CPR on scene, in addition to developing ways to deliver more advanced care to the patient rather than delivering the patient to the care. All of these studies are limited by the fact that they're performed on mannequins, and we're using CPR quality as a surrogate measure because we just can't study patient survival directly. There just aren't enough arrests to be able to put that trial together. At Snowbird, we ended up bringing the Lucas device on and getting the patrol trained up. To my knowledge, we haven't had an arrest since it was implemented, but if we do, I'll bring you that case. If you're a member of a ski patrol or mountain rescue organization that uses mechanical CPR or that decided not to, I'd love to hear from you. Any interesting cases, I'd love to bring you on the show and talk about it. That's all for this episode. To be clear, I have no financial relationships with Lucas, Autopulse, or any mechanical CPR company, nor any relationship with Cascade Toboggans. As always, if you like what you hear and you want to support the podcast, please give it a 5-star rating and review, and tell your friends, your wilderness medicine interest group, your fellow residents, your fellow search and rescue members. And if you want to hear more about a particular topic, reach out to me through email at wildernessmedicineupdates@gmail.com or at wildmedupdates on Twitter. Until next time, stay fit, stay focused, stay ready, and have fun. Wilderness Medicine Updates is written, hosted, and produced by Patrick Fink, MD, all rights reserved. Our music is produced by Nathan Fink. Any information included on this podcast is for your education only and does not constitute medical advice, does not constitute any patient relationship between you, our listener, and any of the producers, hosts, or guests of the